to you live from the Cultural Hall. This is the Mormon News Report for the week of February 19th, 2018. We are your weekly dose of Mormonism.
With an award-winning amount of snark because, folks, we're kind of a big deal on a fairly irrelevant social media site that, well, frankly, falsely inflates my ego. Brian, we are the 2017 Weedy Award-winning Best Mormon Podcast of the Year.
We are a huge deal in a really small circle, Brant.
And with, I don't know, like 20 different nominees, I have a feeling that we won because the spread was so big and great over everyone. But I will say this. Thank you to all of our supporters who went out there and voted for us. We started this podcast on a whim back in July, and the fact that we won this year and we were up against some tough competition, Lindsey Hanson Park's Year of Polygamy, the Cultural Hall's podcast network, and a couple others, I'm feeling pretty proud that we did that.
Hey, you know, it impressed my wife, and that's really all that I could ever ask for. So you won something. You won a major award. Are you going to get anything? I was like, just the recognition and the ego boost.
So my parents actually voted, and they were like, oh, that's awesome. You won. So when do you get like a trophy or something? And I was like, I don't think you understand how this works. It's not a trophy.
No, it's just a blog post recognition. Yeah. But you know what? So the funny thing is that I jokingly said when we won the award, I was like, oh, good thing your parents pulled through on that one because otherwise we might not have won. So I guess that's literal.
Yeah, they literally did. Both of them voted. And I think they sent it to my siblings and they voted too. And it's like, okay, yeah, we'll see.
That's great. My wife was like, oh yeah, that's right. You asked me to vote on that. I totally forgot.
Oh, well, that's great. At least did she actually vote? Because Ashley's like, no, less about that stuff.
No. She didn't vote. It was after that. She's like, oh, you won? Oh yeah, that's right. That was that thing you wanted me to vote on, huh?
Thanks for the support, honey.
Yeah, appreciate that's right. Thanks for the support. Yeah. Hey, you know, it is what it is. It does make me feel good though that people are listening to our show, that they like our show, and that they're willing to put a vote out for us. So thank you everybody who turned in your vote. We really do appreciate it. Should we get into what we talked about last week, the question that we threw out and what kind of responses we might have gotten?
Yeah, so it was, I'll forewarn everyone, this is kind of a heavy show this week. We are going to get more into the abuse allegations and what's going on within the LDS church, but we wanted to know, what were some of your stories about going to a bishop over a serious domestic issue? And I think for both Brian and I, it was important to hear not only the good, but the bad. Or maybe it's the other way around, the bad plus the good, because for as many horror stories that are out there, there are good stories out there. So we got two this week that I want to read. So both of these are anonymous. The first one says, I mentioned to a stake leader years ago that there were women in the stake who were in pain and were not feeling heard by church leaders. He said, I needed to tell him who they were, because if there was a need to discipline them, he needed to take action. He did not ask about why they were in pain or express concern for them. This is the last time I ever spoke to him about any concern. I just sought other ways to minister to my sisters. Brian, I have a situation, and I'll try and be as vague as I could, where I was in a group setting and we were discussing some of what was going on with the ordained women movement. And this was around the time of like Nyland McBain's Women at Church. And so there's a lot of discussion on women in the LDS church. And this individual was fairly prominent within church leadership. And this individual said, you know, if there's anybody, and it was a male, by the way, if there's anybody who has questions about this, you tell them to come talk to me. And it wasn't in a situation like they're talking about, but it was in a situation of, you tell them to come talk to me and I'll make it right. And I'm sitting here going, so if it's a person who already has concerns over the place and the role of LDS women in church, her going to you, a male who doesn't know anything about these things, I know this for a fact, and saying, we'll have a discussion on that. What good is that going to do?
But, Brant, I think that you underestimate the power of mansplaining.
I think you underestimate the power of, I need to be careful. I think you underestimate the extreme confidence of middle-aged white dudes. I'll put it that way. So anyways, so let's get into another one. This is from another anonymous emailer. She wrote, I've been married for 9 years to a man who was, I was married for 9 years to a man who was abusive. He would slap me, pull my hair, beat me with a belt, and choke me. The progression of violence was slow and always came the promise of it being the last time. I never reported any of it until we were separating. 10 years ago, I went to my bishop to tell him we were separating and describe the abuse. At that point, I still wanted to save my marriage. I was asking for his help to save my marriage. My bishop referred us to a marriage counselor and was helpful in getting me moved out of our home while we separated. He didn't let me leave his office without the contact information of a counselor. He even made arrangements for the ward to help pay for it. He followed up to make sure I had set it all up. I went to the marriage counselor and my husband came twice. It wasn't many weeks of being separated and away from the abuse that I realized I could never go back and the divorce was the right choice for the situation. When I told my bishop the same thing, he was completely supportive and understood the decision. And our decision was completely different when I came seeking counsel on leaving and getting a divorce versus being abused and wanting to stay. That bishop had the humility to understand that our problems needed professional help and he made sure it happened. That being said, the one thing that has bothered me is that there never was any church discipline that took place as far as I know. My husband quit going to church as soon as I moved out and didn't have a calling at the time either. And I think those were factors in a lack of church discipline. My father, who has been a bishop twice himself, was very upset that my ex-husband remained a member of the church in seemingly good standing once the abuse came to light. 2 years ago, my ex-husband began the process of getting approval to be sealed to his current wife. I received a request from the bishop to write a letter on my feelings on that application that would be reviewed by the First Presidency. I went to my current bishop for counsel on what I should share of the details of our marriage. He counseled me to provide all the information I could. He said, quote, "Information precedes revelation," end quote. And my ex-husband's bishop, stake present, and ultimately the First Presidency needed the information I could provide for revelation they would need. Writing that letter was extremely difficult. The writing of this letter ended up being one of the more spiritual and healing experiences I have had and led me to greater understanding and appreciation of Jesus Christ and the atonement, which I was able to express in the letter. My ex-husband's bishop's reply to my letter further helped, as he said he would be counseling with their stake present on how to proceed, and he wasn't discounting anything that I had related. Until I went through this process, I didn't know how much I needed to know that this abuse had caused me so much pain, had broken me, mattered to someone beside myself. It was serious and harmful to me. It wasn't something I could just shake off and forget. One bishop I counseled with about some of the effects I was struggling with over the abuse immediately recognized that I was not coming to him for counsel, but coming to him, Jesus Christ, for answers to my barrage of questions. He acknowledged all that he didn't know and understand himself with all my questions and experience. He shared and counseled on the things he did understand and know, and we worked through that. What a victim needs and is ready to do is also different. Some bishops err on the side of mercy, others on the side of justice. Some simply err. But then we all do. I know all my bishops were learning right along with me, and I cannot and will not fault them for that. And Brian, I think this perfectly articulates the reason why it's important to have both of these stories out there, because for every bishop or LDS church leader who is not going to do the right thing, you do have stories of individuals who do the right thing. And I think the problem is, and we'll get into this a little bit later as we get more into the show, but the problem is the stories about those who do things incorrectly are always going to be the ones that come out. But there are good and faithful leaders who strive to be like Jesus Christ within the LDS church. The problem is there are things that we could do to be better. And the fact that things still happen, I don't know if we're ever going to completely get away with that, but or get away from that. But the fact that things still happens and the fact that we could still have story after story after story shows me that there is room for improvement. But I think it's important that we hear both sides of these stories, because it's our real lived Mormon experience.
I'm really glad that we had a story with a helpful bishop that showed a lot of empathy and was also willing to help out with finding resources and mourn with her. I think that is, in my opinion, the best case scenario, because you've got a bishop here who understands that he's not a professional counselor or therapist, but that he does have some resources available that he can offer. And the biggest thing of all is being able to offer compassion and empathy to somebody who's broken and needs to have somebody to just say, I understand, and I believe you, and I want to help you as much as I can in my limited capacity. I mean, we don't, you know, we're going to talk about this, I think, later in another article, but, you know, we need to stop thinking of our bishops as marriage therapists, but as fellow human beings and as some, you know, the person in our ward who has been asked for this particular point in time for a few years to sit and be the shoulders that the burden of the ward rests upon.
Yep. I agree with you.
So anyway, I'm really glad that we had both of those stories. I thank you very much for those who write in to our questions.
Yep. I am with you. Okay. Let's get into the news, because we have a lot this week. First of all, I don't know if you know this, but there was a Category 4 cyclone in Tonga and Samoa. I didn't hear anything about this.
I think we've been so caught up in our news here on the mainland that, you know, we tend not to see this stuff.
Go figure. So this was in Tonga and Samoa, and this Category 4 cyclone, they named it Gita, is 145 mile per hour winds. The LDS Church issued a statement saying all missionaries serving in Samoa, Apia, and the Tonga Nukuafaola mission are safe as Tropical Cyclone Gita moves through the region, said Daniel Woodruff, spokesman for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Missionaries in Tonga are taking refuge in church buildings away from the coast and have taken necessary precautions and preparations to keep them safe, he's added. We pray for all those in the South Pacific who are impacted by this powerful storm. So, Brian, I think you're right. Like, there's a lot of stuff that happens here on the mainland, but there is stuff that happens outside of here, and good to hear that the missionaries are safe.
Yeah. I hope the best for the Isle of Tonga and stuff. They get a lot of cyclones and hurricanes coming through, and it just devastates them every time. So I hope the best for them to be able to pick up the pieces.
I don't think they have the infrastructure that that we do. So this is a horribly awkward transition. Speaking of infrastructure, and potentially infrastructure sometimes goes with governments. And anyways, let me try.
I see where you're going. I know where you're going next on this, Brent.
That was really, really bad. I'll just go into it. This is from NPR. Public officials in town with polygamous sect resign after elections. So this is talking about the town of Hilldale. I think it's Colorado, isn't it?
Yes.
It is Colorado.
It is Colorado, yeah.
So they elected a new mayor. Her name is Donna Jessup. She left the FLDS church about 4 years ago with her family, and she is the first woman and also the first quote-unquote apostate to be mayor of Hilldale. And she said that she respects those who have resigned for following their beliefs. So what actually happened? There were about a dozen resignations, and they were from all different areas of the government, mostly city council seats and the mayor's office. One of the employees cited conflict of religion as the reason for his resignation. He said in his resignation letter that it is against his faith to follow a woman or to work with apostates, which is the FLDS words for those who have left or have been kicked out of the church. So we actually reached out to Donya Jessup, and we didn't get a comment back from her, but this will be interesting. This is a small thing now, but I do wonder if something like this is going to be something that other people are going to pay attention to, and then we might potentially have some sort of a religious freedom lawsuit or whatever. But it's also, I don't mean to speak disparagingly of Hilldale, but it's also a very, very small community, and there are sometimes in small communities like that with a weird, but it's just,
yeah, whether it's a legal issue or not, it's going to happen just because of this, you know, the surrounding demographic of who has the power to vote and put people in and whatnot. So what's interesting to me, though, is that, yeah, I mean, it was I'm kind of glad that that whoever it was that wrote in the letter saying that it's against his faith to follow a woman or work with apostates, I'm kind of glad that he just put it right out there and just said exactly how it is, because at least then you can address the issue as opposed to skirting around it in some sort of a vague way. It's like, we know exactly what his issues are, but here's my question. Is it more because it's a woman, or is it more because she's an apostate, according to your definition? If it was a male who had left the FLDS church, would you have as big of an issue because he's an apostate? So, you know, I don't know. I'm not saying that they would, right? I'm saying that maybe a male apostate would have just as much, you know, resignations, but part of me thinks that it's kind of the double whammy of being both a woman and former FLDS in that area.
Yeah. And I think the thing is, it's easy to sit there and go, oh, give me a break. Look at these people. But it's also a matter of this is a very quirky town with a very quirky history, and I'm not excusing it at all, but I'm also sitting here saying, let's let them be a quirky outlier. There's a lot of issues in Hilldale, and that's the way that I view it.
You know, on the other hand, they are going through some changes now, and this is probably what they need in the long run to be able to try to shift some of the, you know, what's been going on in the town.
I mean, the fact that it's their first female mayor, that's a big deal in and of itself. So it'll be interesting to see how things go there, especially because now that she's in there and she's kind of an apostate in their eyes. I don't know. Okay. Brian, we have not played very nicely with LDS Living. I think that's fair to say, right?
Yeah, they've been kind of on our hit list, and you know, I could probably add an S in front of hit list, but yeah,
we'll save that for the deep cuts if we want to add that. But let me say this. So you sent me this article, and I was like, oh boy. So I'm going to read you the title of the article. You Are My People, Inactive Gay Mormon Shares Powerful Insights After Attending Church for the First Time in Years. And I was like, okay, all right, show me what you got. Holy crap, Brian. I went from despising LDS Living to almost crying as I read this. That's how great this was. This was great. I got to read a couple of pieces. I stopped attending the LDS church services regularly after coming out as gay 10 years ago. The same year, the First Presidency wrote a letter to be read aloud in LDS congregations asking church members to devote their time and resources in support of Prop 8 and similar referendums around the world defining marriage as being only between a man and a woman. And I will say this, Brian, as you and I have traveled on our journeys through the internet, everything that happened in Prop 8, it was a major, major milestone for people. And it really upset a lot of people. And this is an example of that. So he said, imagine my surprise then to get a Facebook message from my friend saying the bishop and his wife in her mom's ward had organized a meeting for and about the needs of LGBTQ Latter-day Saints. So I've heard of other stories like this. And these are some great meetings that they're doing where they're inviting gay members, they are inviting bishops and stake presidents, and it is a message of inclusion, a message of we still want you in our ward. That's the best place for you to be. I thought about sitting in the deafening silence of Mike. So he's talking a little bit about how he had gone and driven up to the different temples and just sat there and watched the temples. He said, I thought about sitting in the deafening silence of my car all those nights with only the lights around the temple breaking through the darkness. I remember sobbing for hours at a time until my eyes were so red and swollen, I couldn't always drive myself back home. I thought about what it meant to feel lost and alone for so many years, to be both within and without when it came to my native faith. I realized that not despite, but because of that pain, I needed to be at that meeting. So how do we get there? And he's talking, he goes to the meeting and then he follows it up with like, these are all the experiences I had, and talks about the concept of that the church is, and the ward is a family, and there's so much Christ-like love there. And he said, so how do we get there to this area where we can have all this Christ-like love within our ward families? We invite each other to share our stories and then we listen. We just listen. We gather and invite. We welcome and include. We turn down the vitriol and turn up to full volume the actual meaning of love. We claim each other and we go on claiming each other time and again, no matter what happens, for we are all part of the same body of Christ. This was so good. And I think it leads back to what we heard Ty Mansfield say last week when he said, we need to hear all these stories. And I'm reading this and just, I'm feeling the sting in my eyes, thinking that maybe my house is a little bit dusty because I can't possibly be showing my emotions. But I'm sitting here saying, this is so good. And I think about the demographics of the people that are going to read LDS Living and how important this is for them to read that. And we are seeing a very interesting shift going on. And I'm glad that it's not so much about the politics of the situation. Should we or shouldn't we allow this? But it seems like we as an LDS faith are kind of turning the corner a little bit to realize they're children of God too, and we should probably love them. And you know what? This is hard for them. So they probably need our love more than most. And I was just so impressed with this.
Yeah. Yeah. So was I. I thought this is why I sent the article along to you. I was like, okay, we got to talk about this one because, you know, I mean, I've said it before. It's the inconsistency in LDS Living that drives me the most bonkers. I wish that they were a little bit more consistent in the quality of stuff that they put out because let's face it. Sometimes they put out flaming piles of dog poo.
Yep.
And, you know, and sometimes I just want to ask the editor who's in charge of content, like, what are you thinking? Like, are you just thinking, oh, this will be massively clickbaity, so I'll just throw this out there? Is there any thought behind it at all? Or is it just because you've got content, you just keep just pumping it out and pumping it out and pumping it out, hoping for the numbers? I'm not sure. But once in a while, they throw out an article that I'm just like, yes, that's yes. This is exactly what we need. And in fact, I would say that this is a far better article than the last one that the most recent one that we got from them on LGBT issues, which was the two lesbian gals who were divorcing in order to go back to church and be in full fellowship. I mean, that wasn't a bad article, and I thought that they handled it, you know, fairly sensitively. But at the same time, it's like, okay, so yeah, they got to split up their marriage in order to be able to be in full fellowship in the church, and that's just not a message that is going to sit well with a lot of people in the LGBT community right now. So, you know, but this one, on the other hand, I'm like, yes, let's model good behavior and let's model what a ward can do to try to welcome people in. Just real quick before I move on to the next one, I can say that when I served in a bishopric in the Seattle area, our demographics, we hit the predominantly gay and lesbian neighborhood in Seattle. And that was something, and this is way back in, gosh, this is way before Proposition 8. So
like, you know, 1924?
Yeah, I think it was like 24, maybe 25, something like that. It was just shortly after World War I. So
of course.
You know, we were kind of picking up the pieces. A large part of our ministry and our efforts were to try to invite our gay and lesbian and transgender brothers and sisters and just throw our arms around them and just say, you know, you're welcome here. And yeah, I understand that that comes at a bit of a cost, because, you know, we're not offering full fellowship for those who are actively engaged in relationships that weren't considered, you know, within the bounds of temple recommends and things like that. But we wanted them there, and we included them. And just what a huge difference that makes to put that for that message forward, rather than we don't understand you, we don't understand the lifestyle that you've chosen, and we would rather just sweep you under the rug.
Well, and additionally, talking again about LDS Living, they aggregate a lot of content. So what they do is they will take what somebody else has posted, they'll grab the good bits out of it, and then they'll post a link down at the bottom that says, to read more, click here.
True.
So
that's true.
Own content. But this, I think this was original.
A submitted article.
And it was long, and it was really good. I recommend everyone go read it. It was really good. Brian, there was tragedy this week as we had another school shooting, this time in Florida. It was, I still have young daughters. You've got older kids who are going to middle school.
I've got a 13-year-old in middle school. Yep.
Yeah. And I can't imagine being in a situation where, you know, you have to talk to your kids about this. And
yeah, the
person that my wife and I...
And I did.
So just so everyone's aware, there were two LDS church members that were among the victims in the Florida school shooting. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has confirmed that two members were among the students that were shot. The LDS church identified those two victims as 14-year-old Elena Petty, who was killed in the incident, and 17-year-old Madeline Wilford, who was seriously injured. The family of Elena Petty put out this statement. Once again, we find ourselves as a nation and as community faced with a tragic loss of life. I'm sorry, this is from the LDS Church. Once again, we find ourselves as a nation and as communities faced with a tragic loss of life and incomprehensible sorrow following the shooting at Majorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida. Among the many injured or killed were two members of our faith. To all the victims and their loved ones, we extend our love. These are hours filled with grief, emptiness, and a terrible sense of loss. We unite our prayers with millions of others who are mourning and praying for them. A statement from the LDS Church said, "Brian, I think let's do this. I want to know. I've heard some things that were talked about, and granted, this is all hearsay from the internet. I've heard some things that were said in LDS Church buildings about this, and it wasn't very good. So, remind me. Let's talk about that on the deep cuts. Remind me about that, because I got to tell you these.
Yeah, and maybe I'll get into my thoughts a little bit more on this in the deep cuts as well. I will just say this much: that there are some schools that are organizing planned walkouts." Because of this. And I think the first one is on March 20th and the second one is on April 20th. April 20th, the significance of that date is that it was the anniversary of Columbine. Mm-hmm. So, which is kind of considered one of the first big school mass shooting in this, you know, recent 50 years.
Yeah. By the way, crazy to think that I was a freshman. It was at the end of my freshman year in high school. And that was the first big one. And yeah, it's just crazy to me to sit there and go from then until now. It's I won't sit there and say it's become commonplace, but
it's become too common.
Yeah. Yeah. The fact that it's almost, and I'm not trying to make light of it at all. I mean this in all seriousness. The fact that it seems like it's becoming a yearly thing is
well, weekly. Weekly. It's, you know, if you average it out, we're having one a week. It's become an epidemic. So I was talking to my daughter about it a little bit. And I said, look, if your fellow classmates, plan on participating in one of these walkouts, you have my full support to join them, you know, and even if your principal says, you know, I'm going to flunk anybody who goes on the walkout. This is something where
just for context, the walkout is in response to
response to Congress being inactive in changing any laws around gun reform.
Gotcha. Yep.
So basically what they're trying to do is use these walkouts as a platform to get enough media attention to force the issue. And there's also faculty members too. This is the Florida school in particular. There's faculty members and students who are saying, we're going to walk out and we're not coming back until Congress has actually acted on this, which is a really strong statement. And they're hoping that other schools will join them. Personally, this is just
hold on, not to make light of it, to make light of it. But I don't think they're going to have a problem recruiting any kids.
Right.
Just because it's like, hey, we're going to walk out of school. So,
right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No. And I remember when I was, you know, and this will date me. I was, in high school is when the first Persian Gulf War happened.
So here I am talking about Columbine. You're talking
right. Yeah. Yeah. So we're talking Bush, Bush era here.
92 issue.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I graduated in 94, but anyway, so we had a walkout in school over the Persian Gulf War. Right. And I joined it because that's what you do, right? It's like, oh, cool. Yeah. I mean, I was kind of a punk kid anyway, so I was never one of those like goody two shoes that sat there and be like, oh no, that's against the rules. We shouldn't do that. I was like, heck yeah, I'm marching
here.
I'm marching in my small little, very white middle class, suburban, town. We're gonna march and we're gonna end this war. Actually, it was a naval community too, so that actually did make some stink. But anyway. The point is what I was going to say is, from a historical perspective, nothing ever really changes in our country until people who feel victimized have had enough and stand up and refuse to be silenced.
Yeah.
And well, so that's what I'm hoping for.
When you're thinking about these students, this is now a reality for them. And
right.
maybe that'll be the galvanizing thing to get them involved, and
I'm thinking that it's going to be student driven.
Yep.
If something's going to happen, it's going to be because there's enough students who are terrified to go to school each day to where they just like, okay, we've had enough of this. And let's keep in mind that in a few years these students are going to be labeled as something else, voters. Anyway, I think we should talk more about that in the deep cuts, because I've got things.
And you got thoughts. Okay. Yeah. All right. So speaking of politics, that is a nice transition right there. Speaking of politics. Oh,
that's professional stuff right there, Brant.
We can finally take the bow off of the transparent gift wrapping of the package that we've had for a year.
I love that transparent gift wrapping. That's the perfect way to describe it.
Mitt, our old pal Mittens, Mitt Romney, is running for U.S. Senate in Utah. Brian, I'll give you.
You got to be kidding.
To pick your jaw up off the floor. I know it's a shock. All right, so this is from Vox. Instead, so Romney actually posted, he posted a video, and I would say it was really well done. I was very impressed. It was like, whoa, this is some guy running for Senate in a place that he knows he's going to win by like 95% of the vote. It was still a really well done video. And he took some jabs at the Trump administration. Anyways, here's what Vox wrote. Instead, Romney's message made subtle jabs at the administration and Republican-led government, decrying overrun government spending, and in light of a recent failed immigration debate in the Senate, censuring Washington's message of exclusion towards immigrants. Quote, Utah has balanced its budgets. Washington is buried in debt, Romney said. Utah welcomes legal immigrants from around the world. Washington sends immigrants a message of exclusion. And on Utah's Capitol Hill, people treat one another with respect. So it was.
Apparently, he's never stepped foot into Utah's Capitol Hill.
Yeah. And additionally, listen.
You fetch and sit down. that's Utah's Capitol Hill.
Well, I was going to say, the thing with Utah's Capitol is not only are you going to hear, just absolutely coarse language like that, but they're going to be so passive aggressive about the whole thing.
Right. Yeah, we'll get to that bill. Uh-huh. Yeah, we'll get right on top of that bill.
Appreciate you, brother Matt. Appreciate you. Right. So this was an interesting nugget from Vox. They said it's been rumored that Romney, who once made headlines calling for Trump's tax returns, will tone down his rhetoric against the administration.
No, I hope not.
I hope that he knows he has ultimate job security.
Seriously.
What do you got to lose?
No, seriously. We need to get him like a white horse. Because that's what I want. I want him to be in the, I want him to be in the Senate, and I want him to be on the Senate floor, but I don't want him to be standing. I want him to be sitting atop a white horse and just laying in. Yep. On Trump's policies. That's my dream. If that happens, then I can die a happy man.
Yeah, we'll see. I think he might be he's an older style Republican. He's a conservative, and there is a concern that I have that he might do party over.
Yeah, but he's sure he's perhaps old guard and he's perhaps establishment conservative, but he is a Massachusetts conservative.
Yes, that's true.
So, we'll see. I mean, I know that every chance I have, because I've got him on my on my text messaging on my phone. So every chance I have, I'll remind him to kind of just dial up the heat a little bit, Mitt.
I mean, How do you think I came up with the pet name of Mittens for him? Right? Or BFF says I can call him that.
That's what it says. It's what it says on your phone. When yep. Whenever he calls you, it says Mittens.
It's Mittens, and it's an emoji of a mitten. Like, that's how tight we are. So speaking of Republicans, this is from The Guardian. Mormons want to save Republican Party soul, but is it too late?
Yes.
I
thought you were asking me. Yes.
Is it too late?
It's too late.
No. So this was a really interesting piece for people who want to know a little bit of history on like Mormons and politics. But I want to quote a little bit from what Kathleen Flake says. So she's at the University of Virginia, and she does a lot with Mormon studies. And Brian, everything that I've read from Kathleen, she's really, really bright. She's really good with this stuff. So she goes, Donald Trump, and by the way, Kathleen also doesn't mince words. Donald Trump is not a good husband. And that is a strong indictment in Mormonism. He violates boundaries all over the place, and Mormons are very much about boundaries, which is just, yep.
So when she's saying that he's not a good husband, she's not saying, like, metaphorically, that he's not a good husband for the nation, for the state. She's saying that he's literally not a good husband to his wife.
So
just to make that clear.
Yeah. So. And I just love that. She also noted that compared with conservative evangelicals, Mormons seem to be less focused on core right-wing issues like abortion or political dominance in the Supreme Court. Politically, Mormons just might be more invested in the character of their leaders than they are in specific issues, and perhaps just generally less invested in the culture war, she said. I agree with her on the first part. I kind of disagree with her on the second part.
Mormon. Yeah, I know a lot of single-issue voters still within Mormonism that are, you know, it's if you're pro-life, you've got my vote. So
they also talked with Jana Reese, a friend of the report, I might add, and she argued that the patriarchy manifests itself in holding women. So they're talking a little bit about how Mormons and women's and the patriarchal culture that we have. And she said that patriarchy manifests itself in holding women on pedestals as sweet and wonderful, in contrast to Trump's misogyny, which is hate-filled and obvious, like Trump himself. When Trump brags about going after married women and quote-unquote grabbing them, well, there is a respect for women in Mormonism that is quite old-fashioned. This is from Kathleen Flake. She said that old-fashionedness can strike one as paternalistic and sexist, depending on the circumstance, but it also reflects a sincere ethic of care towards women. In Salt Lake City, people still open doors for women. And I think that's true. If you were to talk to a Mormon, I don't think that they would think that they are a sexist or a misogynistic group, or that they have a patriarchal group. I think that what happens is this learned helplessness that sometimes manifests itself in some women because they're so dependent on men for everything within Mormonism, it comes out in weird ways. And that's why I liked what they were saying about, you know, sometimes we put women on a pedestal.
The pedestalization is a very real thing. And that's something that, I mean, yeah, it's definitely rich in Mormon culture, but it's also something that came very strongly out of like the culture in the 1950s and early 1960s, right?
Which is where a lot of Mormonism still is.
As far as its social norms, it is. Real quick plug, a good book on this topic is Pedestals and Podiums by Martha Bradley.
Okay. Yep.
Highly recommend picking that up. Anyway.
Very good. Okay, so let's get into the top story. So, again, here's your content warning. We're going to be talking about abuse. Again, we're going to be talking about the Rob Porter story.
Wait, I'm sorry. Before you go back to that, I had something to say about this last story that you were talking about here and what they missed.
Okay. Yes, what did they...
So, and then we'll get into our top story. So they missed all the Mormons who have been involved in the Tea Party movement.
Ah, yeah.
Right. They didn't say anything about Mike Lee, for instance. Even Orrin Hatch, who hasn't necessarily been part of the Tea Party movement. He's always been more of a centrist. But, you know, with all of this, I mean, he gushes, I hate to say it, but he gushes over Trump, right? As far as like, I haven't heard him criticize Trump yet. On anything. Oh, well, that's not true. I have heard him criticize when Trump says something absolutely outlandish, but it takes a really, really outlandish tweet before Orrin Hatch raises his, you know, nearly deceased head and actually says something in opposition to it. For the most part, it's just, yeah, whatever, you know, just, you know, pass on all of his legislation.
To me, he really does strike me as one of those old guard Republican Party men. That's like,
yeah. Well, and he does. I mean, I'm not sure that he even knows what Twitter is. So I think it's kind of hard to expect him to respond to all of, you know, for him, Twitter is something that birds do. But at any rate, Twitter. What's this Twitter? But going back to the original question, that about Mormons saving the Republican Party's soul. I don't know, man. It seems like it's a really mixed bag as far as what we have out there. Because, yeah, I mean, we've got Mormons who are standing up and saying, you can't say those outlandish things and you can't be such a hedonist. But on the other hand, they're not really challenging much other than just rhetoric. So,
I think that Mormons are going to be very, very concerned with the social issues and protecting those social issues. And because majority of Republicans are conservative, and because it seems like we're getting more and more extreme in our polarization of those things, I think that that's why they stick with it. But even still, you know, you look at people like Evan McMullen, who won Utah with 26, or won, who got 26% of the vote.
Yeah.
Anyway. Would have made things interesting. But you look at that, and it's like,
yeah,
there's an appetite there. Now, the big question is going to be, so you take 2016 was a weird year anyways, right? 2012 was kind of an outlier year too because of the Mitt Romney thing. But if you look back to, like, I don't know, John McCain, George Bush, McCain's probably the closest one that I could think of. It was still fairly prominent. The big question is going to be what starts happening going forward. You know, if Donald Trump runs unencumbered in 2020, so if he doesn't have a challenger, how are Mormons going to vote? Especially if I don't know, if we see a strong decline, that could be a very interesting one in support for Donald Trump in Utah. But if it goes back to, well, as long as it's not insert Democratic nominee here, well, I think you can see that Mormons still play a strong role in the Republican
Party. I think it'd be really interesting to see if a pro-life Catholic Democrat came out of the woodworks and see what, you know, that'd be an interesting race.
Yeah, but you're talking just in the nationals.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that would be really interesting. Especially if it was more of a blue dog type Democrat.
Right.
Cause I don't know how well. Yeah. Anyway, no, 2020 is going to be interesting.
We can go back to the top story now. Thank you, Brant, for letting me reverse this.
you got your bid in. So you're good now. Okay. So this one, so we've got quite a few stories. So we were talking earlier this week, Brian, and what we found is that it seems like when a big story breaks, week one has been, all right, we got to talk about the story. And then week two, the commentary starts coming in. And that's when we kind of start contextualizing everything, because commentary can be good or commentary can be not so good. I don't want to say bad, but not as good as I can think. And the reason I say that is because what we saw this week with the Rob Porter story, we saw a lot of different commentary and I saw a lot of different reactions to people. So let's get into a couple of them. The first one is from a website called The Cut. And this is from Judy Dushku. And she said, I've been a Mormon for 75 years. Here's what I know about the church and assault. And so she was talking a little bit about what she's seen with women when it happens. She said, in the last decade, it has been widely discussed and acknowledged as a problem. Yes, there are manuals for ward bishops that are intended to help them deal with the complaints of women who describe abuse. But everyone knows about incidents of spousal abuse in every ward, which often go minimized or ignored. I'm not trying to discredit that, but I think the problem is when you write a statement like that, I don't know if that's the case in every single ward.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very broad general statement to make. I mean, first of all, you're assuming that people actually know each other that well.
Yeah. Well, I think that the problem is to sit there and go, look, I do not know everything that's happening in my ward. I don't. To sit there and go, we need to start looking at everyone and are you doing it? I don't like generalizations is what I'm trying to say. And I like couched nuanced language. So she goes on, are Mormons worse than other people? Of course not. But I have a special kind of sympathy for a very large demographic subset of women in this country, women who have not been well taught to defend themselves. I also know, of course, many fine Mormon men. But I also know Mormon men who laugh together in a group, often at church, enjoying the collegiality and sense of a united brotherhood that they expect to continue, while ignoring the fact that at least one of them, I knew, had left a battered wife at home. Women have told me that sharply hypocritical moments like these are among the most difficult to recollect. Those times when they had repeatedly told a bishop about how their husband hit or punched or shook them, and then went to a church event, and had to watch that same bishop interact with the abuser husband as though he was the most innocent of men enjoying a good time together. Despite this, over the last 5 or 6 years, I have seen evidence that Mormon bishops are maybe learning to handle reports of family violence better. Many now recommend professional counseling, or in extreme cases, recommend calling the police, even standing alongside a woman to support her calling the police and filing a claim. But this is still new. And these are not all Mormon bishops. Many are just like the ones that Porter's wives describe. They warn against going public or making an accusation to law enforcement, or even having the bishop talk to both of them, indicate that he knows what's going on, so as to keep the stories of abuse quiet. And I think, I like your work, your word of broad generalizations. I think there are broad generalizations, but I think what we as Mormons don't do a very good job at is looking at ourselves and saying, could we be better at this? And I think this is one of those examples where those stories are real. I don't think Judy Dushku's exaggerating those stories. Those are real stories.
Yeah, and no, definitely not. But
they come from a place of pain, of probably her and her interacting with some of these women and the women that she's seen go through this.
Yeah. No, I don't discredit it at all.
But my concern is this. Sometimes when we go broad generalizations, the people who need to hear it are going to be the ones that turn their ears off. And that's where I get it. I get what she's doing there. Yeah. I just wish it would be a little more. Oh gosh, I'm just going to get in trouble everywhere with this. I wish it was a little more careful. And I know a guy telling a woman talking about domestic abuse, saying to be careful about how she talks about it, is really dicey and dangerous. But I don't say be careful as in you shouldn't be talking about it. If you want it's more about trying to reach some of the people that I know that have reached out to me saying, come on, you can't be still talking about this. Come on, what about this article? What's the deal with this? Those are the people that need to hear it, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I'm going to say something that's probably not going to be very popular either, but it's, when she said that this is all fairly new and that bishop's kind of getting more involved in these things and trying to, you know, possibly fill up police reports, show more support, finding therapists, that it's all fairly new within Mormonism, it did make me wonder, like, okay, so what's it been like for the past 7,500 years, because domestic abuse, I hate to say it, is not new. And I know that in our society, it was unfortunately more tolerated 100 years ago than it is now. But it wasn't, I mean, it was still tolerated to some extent in the 1950s and 1960s, but we started making a shift away from tolerating women being abused in marriages to wanting to do something about it. And of course, and this is where I'm going to say something that's stupid, because it goes back to this idea of men having to fix everything. Right. And I don't want to leave that impression with any of our listeners that I'm saying, well, you know, men just need to step in and fix this, because that's not what I'm saying at all. But I wonder if, you know, 50, 60 years ago, if a woman was to come and show, you know, report that her husband had been abusing her and show some maybe obvious physical signs of battery, if they wouldn't have rounded up the elders' quorum and gone and beat the crap out of the guy. Yeah, I don't know.
It wouldn't surprise me. So I'm actually looking on the General Conference, one of the sites that you can look through all the different talks that are ever given in General Conference, and I like to search for it through keywords. So I typed in abuse, and obviously abuse is a little bit dicey, but 1866, Brigham Young. He's talking about people who take the name of God in vain. He's talking about men who take the name of God in vain, are impatient with their families, and often abuse them. Such things should not be among the servants of the Most High God. So it is talked about, but I think what we're getting to is we're getting to a point where we're starting to put much more structured things in place when things like this happen. And we'll get into it. Yeah. There's great piece from Jana Reese on that a little bit later. So this was from BuzzFeed News, and this is an important one to talk about. There is a difference. This is in the wake of Rob Porter allegations, Mormon women say church leaders encourage them to stay with their abusers. This is from Jim Dalrymple. There's an important difference between BuzzFeed and BuzzFeed News. BuzzFeed is what your 45-year-old aunt sends you, because it's all clickbait articles, right? Or your silly 17-year-old niece wants to do what Disney princess are you, the 2010 version, and wants to send.
are those like, you know, top 10 type stories that I totally get sucked into when I should be, like, you know, working in the middle of them, like in the middle of my work day, and I'm just like, oh, I gotta see this.
you have been BuzzFeeded.
I've been BuzzFed.
BuzzFeed News, on the other hand, they do try and do some legitimate reporting. McKay Coppins came from BuzzFeed News. McKay writes for The Atlantic now. McKay at BuzzFeed News was covering the entire Mitt Romney campaign. McKay's like kind of a bright dude. So the interesting thing about this was Jim Dalrymple and BuzzFeed News spoke with more than 20 current and former female members of the LDS Church from seven states for this story, all of whom said they had experienced domestic abuse and then gone to their clergy for help. In most cases, these leaders were bishops, roughly the LDS equivalent of pastors who served on a volunteer basis. In response to their request for guidance, the women said they were told by their bishops to stay in abusive relationships, that their internal salvation could be jeopardized by leaving violent partners, and that they were to blame, and that they were to blame for their marital problems. Though some reported positive experiences with church leaders, every woman who spoke with BuzzFeed News for this story said there are widespread inadequacies in the way local Mormon leaders handle reports of abuse and domestic violence. I saw a few people that were discrediting this, saying, oh, what is this? No, these are the stories. You know what, Brian? In my perfect world, these are the stories that a state president would use when doing priesthood leadership training to say, this cannot happen. And we need to talk about these uncomfortable stories and talk about where did this bishop or where did this leader go wrong? These stories are legitimate stories. And again, I'm not saying that all LDS leaders are bad. You're going to see a lot of the both sides of this. But at the end of the day, like these stories happen because they shouldn't happen. And I'm sure in any other, and I think you mentioned this last week, Brian, in any other faith, they probably are struggling through some of the same things. I think the difference is LDS members have, we set such a high standard for ourselves. And the fact that this happens, and even with well-meaning bishops, it's handled incorrectly. It's that's the reason why it's news.
Yeah, I think that what you just said would be really great if stake presidents could put together kind of a, I don't want to say a shame guide, but something that says, look, this is the reality. This is stuff that happens out there when you don't think this stuff through as bishops, and whether you're intending to cause harm or not, you are. Let's seriously work through this. I mean, there was a video that was leaked from Dallin H. Oakes presenting, this was last week or whatever, here's what you should do in the case of abuse. And it was mostly relying on the 1-800 number, which is great, right? I'm so glad that they put that out there as a resource, that they have professionals that were working, that are on the other end of the phone who can really kind of help bishops guide them through the right questions and what they ought to be doing next. So I'm glad that that video was made. I'm glad that that number was out there. But at the same time, I was also a little bit disheartened that a lot of the rhetoric around it was still kind of just based on your inspiration and based on just, you know, your role as a bishop and the mantle that you've received. You have to use your inspiration to sort of just determine whether or not this is something that you need to pursue. And I'm kind of going, I don't know if we can do that as much anymore. I mean, I don't want to denigrate inspiration and the bishop's right to inspiration, but I don't know if maybe we need to ask more probing questions. And I think that perhaps sometimes that doesn't go far enough, where bishops were just kind of like, well, you know, I didn't really feel the inspiration to move forward on it. You know, well, you made a really big mistake. So I think that we need to talk about that more and just be more realistic about what kind of capacity they really have.
So speaking of some of those mistakes, this is from Fox 13 in Salt Lake City. They actually reached out to they had a couple of women contact them with their stories. And of course, I shouldn't say, of course. And what you're going to find is these are the not so good stories. As a matter of fact, I heard something said about manners once. And they basically said manners, like table manners, are going to be the type of thing that if someone's doing things right, you're not going to notice them. But when they're not doing them right, it's going to be very obvious. And I think this is one of those situations. So one of the women, Bonnie, when I went to a bishop about emotionally abusive behavior, I was given the advice to do something nice for him, like cook his favorite meal.
This should be the gong show now. Yeah. We should have a giant gong in the background, isn't, you know, whacking it away with the stupid stuff.
And I'm sure that bishop was well-meaning, but the more I've been reading this week about what it's like for victims of abuse, just going and talking to someone is such a monumental thing. And that's the reaction you get? Oh, geez. Here's one from Melissa. When I went in with my ex, the bishop ignored the reasons why I wanted a divorce and ignored everything I told him.
Yeah.
And it's rough. So this leads to a very interesting discussion that happened on KUER with Dr. Julie D'Azevedo Hanks. And she said, while Hanks wants the LDS Church to make good on their zero tolerance stance on abuse and provide more intensive training for bishops, she also thinks that responsibility to battery, a very serious crime, isn't the responsibility of a bishop. They aren't qualified. She uses her own husband as an example, whose call as a bishop just months ago. He's a spiritual guide and not an expert in anything else, Hank says. Too often, bishops think that everything is a spiritual problem when it's not. They're not the therapist. They're not the marriage counselor. They're not the physician. And again, you know, hashtag not all bishops, not all leaders, right? But at the same time, the fact that it still happens and the fact that you do have some who feel this way, that's where it is concerning. And it leads back to, I know this is a tired trope, but it leads back to leadership roulette, where you're going to have some bishops who are going to be great. And you're going to have some bishops who are the dirt worst. And while some might say, well, sometimes we're put in a leadership calling to learn something about ourselves, not as a bishop, not when you're dealing with stuff like this. And I think that's the thing that bothers me is there are really good bishops out there. There are some trash ones. And the problem is we're hearing the stories about the trash ones.
And, you know, and there's some really good dads out there, and there's some really crappy dads out there. And sometimes, and there's dads out there that when their daughter comes to them with some really serious emotional heavy concerns weighing on them, they handle it beautifully. And they're just able to really kind of guide their daughter through it. And you know, kind of make things work out. And there's other dads who just don't know what to do, and they just fall flat on their face. So I think that it's the exact same issue when it comes to this, because we're dealing with an untrained clergy where we don't have a lot of training standards and stuff like this. What we're dealing with is just whether or not that guy is a good type of guy to listen to the problems of others and listen to the challenges and the real trauma that people are experiencing.
And in defense of bishops and leaders, they're not trained for this stuff. They don't go through sometimes the years of training that pastors and ministers go through and being exposed to a lot of these things and knowing how to handle it. If you're a brand new bishop, and Brian, you weren't a bishopric, so you probably heard.
And my bishop traveled a lot, so I ended up with a lot of appointments that we would offer. We would say, if you want to wait for the bishop, if it's something that's that important that you want to wait for the bishop, he'll be back in a couple of weeks. But if you need to meet with a bishopric member now, and I did still get people to come through and just say, I got to talk about this. I got to get this off my chest. And yeah, there were some stories where, I mean, here I am, I'm 20. What am I? I'm 27 year old kid just going, you're talking to me about wanting a divorce. And I'm talking to a guy the one that I can recall, I'm talking to a man who wanted to divorce his wife. And I'm just like, buddy, I got nothing for you. Like, that's way above my pay grade. You know, I wish I could give you some counsel, but I've been married for 3 years.
and additionally, that's just the divorce side of things. Like, just think, if you're a brand new bishop and someone's coming to you and just laying all this out and having that deer in the headlights look, or conversely, think if you're a bishop who's been doing it for a while, got it. Know exactly what to do here. Don't you worry. We're going to talk. You pray about it. We'll be good. And it's like, there's value in having lay leadership.
So on the one hand, yeah, cut them some slack because they are lay leaders and they're not trained as in depth as somebody who does this professionally. On the other hand, come on, church, let's make sure they get the right training that they need in order to be able to handle these kinds of situations. That's why we have bishopric trainings held through the stake. We should be utilizing those to try to get some better tools in the hands so that there is more consistent approaches to these types of cases.
Yep, I'm with you. Okay, so last article this week. This is from friend of the report, Jenna Reese. She has a piece in the Salt Lake Tribune. Mormon Church needs to train bishops better and teach them that most domestic violence reports turn out to be true.
Well, it's almost like she listened to me a second ago.
It's great. It's almost like we kind of planned this out or something like that. So again, she was quoting from an Anderson Cooper interview with one of Rob Porter's ex-wives. And this ex-wife said that she was not able to clearly articulate her fear. Jana says that's actually really common with domestic violence. People who are abused may minimize their own situation or have difficulty initiating conversations about it. That is why police officers, pastors, teachers, and other leaders get trained in precisely this. So they know the kinds of specific questions that must get asked, sometimes repeatedly, to get at the truth. And I will add, for my own little side commentary here, if a woman is coming to you saying that her husband got physical, that's one of those times you should probably ask another question. I mean, Brian, I hope I'm not going crazy here.
Well, no, I mean, obviously not. But I think that's sometimes, I don't know. I don't know the psychology of all this, but I got to imagine that sometimes there's a huge fear from their perspective of what this is possibly going to do to disrupt their family, particularly if they've got children together. It's so it's like they need to be heard. They need to know how to deal with this. But at the same time, I think there's this fear of, okay, now is everything just going to flip upside down? And what's my life going to be like? Yep. So, you know, and I want to talk more about this in the deep cuts because I kind of want to talk about Emma Smith.
Ooh, interesting. All right, let me wrap up what Gianna says, and we'll start getting to that. In Mormonism, our system of lay leadership means that a bishop who is in his daily life, an accountant or perhaps a veterinarian, is called out of the blue to be in charge of the spiritual and administrative affairs of a congregation of several hundred people. What training bishops do receive on the job while they're already serving, not in advance as preparation for this huge calling, is scattershot. Then there's the other part of the problem, which is that this is a thoroughly patriarchal system that makes it tough for women to come forward and to be believed as the default response. The LDS Church needs to do better, not only with training bishops, but also teaching them that the vast majority of allegations of domestic violence and sexual assault turn out to be true. True, as in the false reports are in the single digits. And that was, I like Gianna. I like Gianna a lot, and I know that some people are going to be a little upset that she's saying things like that. But Brian, it leads back to what we've been saying. Like, we should be doing a better job. And instead of getting defensive, saying, whoa, not all bishops. Not, I'm sitting here going, why can't we sit there and go, yeah, we could do better.
Yeah.
Not good.
Right. I mean, we shouldn't be relying on hoping that the bishop happens to be really good at dealing with this stuff. So that's okay. The bottom line.
So that wraps. I have a feeling, Brian, that that's kind of probably going to wrap up a lot of the raw.
Yeah. Points. Yeah. We're thinking about what question we wanted to ask our listeners this week. And usually we try to base it on kind of the top story. And this week, our top story was continued coverage of the Rob Porter case. But we'd already asked a question and gotten some really good responses last week. So I think that we want to just switch it up a little bit. Let's talk about Mitt Romney this week is our question of the week. So
I love Mittens.
You know, Mitt Mittens, we are fans. So the Romney video that we were talking about and how he kind of, let's say, needled Trump a little bit in it without naming Trump, right? He's just like the White House, this administration, right? But you clearly know what he's talking about. When he's talking about immigration policies, when he's talking about debt and fiscal financial responsibility, when he's talking about just being civil, right? So those were kind of his big attacks in this ad, which was not an attack ad by any stretch of the imagination, but it was his points of differentiation.
There you go.
Right? What I want to know from our listeners, what I want to hear from you is, do you think he's going to keep that kind of subtle needling tone against the current administration through this entire Senate run and maybe even beyond onto the Senate floor? Or do you think, like we had mentioned earlier, that he's going to kind of dial down the rhetoric and that he's going to appear to kind of fall in line in order to maybe get more vote supports? I mean, we've talked about it before on this show. We're pretty sure that Mitt Romney has, let's say 100% chance of winning the Utah Senate vote, right? It would be a huge shock if he did not win the Utah Senate vote, right? So let's just assume he's in at this point. And now all we're doing is the formalities. Is he going to, because of the amount of ground support that he has in Utah, is he going to continue kind of differentiate himself from Trump and saying, we need to pull the Republican Party back together into a more civil and centrist party? I don't know. What do you think? Do you think
Mitt Romney the great unifier or Mitt Romney the great divider?
Right. What do you think, folks? I kind of butchered that question. It was way too long, but bottom line is, do you think that he's going to continue pushing Trump's buttons or do you think he's going to let off? Email us at mail@mormonnewsreport.com or leave us a voicemail at 801-987-0192 or just respond to us on Facebook or Twitter. We're easy to find. Just search Mormon News Report. On Twitter, we are The Mormon News. And Brant, I understand we've got a book review by Brant this week.
Oh, let's talk about some books. So, Brian, I'm to a point in my life where how about this for a generic statement? I like certain people. I find that I gravitate towards certain writers, and I get to a point where if they're writing something, I want to read everything that they've written and everything that they will write. Like, I'll drop things and read it. And so we got this book from the Maxwell Institute. It was To Be Learned is Good, Essays on Faith and Scholarship, in honor of Richard Lyman Bushman. So what happened was, a couple of years ago, they did a colloquium or a conference, or whatever you want to call it, right? Where they got together a bunch of scholars and they read some essays on Richard Bushman. And so as they were going to do this conference, they were talking with Bushman about it. And Bushman, this is in the introduction, in characteristic fashion, when we sought his approval for a festschrift, he demurred, protesting that he had been praised enough. Eventually, he agreed on the condition that the undertaking focus on the intersections between the life of the mind and the life of faith, and that, not least, this be done from the point of view of LDS scholars. And I think that anyone who knows Richard Bushman knows that that is something that is he's very passionate about. Not only the faithful side of the LDS Church and being an active church member, but also the expansive side. That's the reason why he was one of the founders of Dialogue, that expansiveness. And so I was like, okay, this is interesting.
So hold on, Brant. So just to define the word festschrift for our listeners, it means a collection of writings published in honor of a scholar. And here's my thing. Yeah, it said that he demurred on the festschrift, right? Which is so ivory tower.
It's still like an academic thing. Right?
I demur on this festschrift. But if it was a roast, I bet he totally would have done it.
Listen, at the end, Brian, when I finally retire from this podcasting thing, as I go into my second retirement at some point, when I finally retire, I want all the podcasters to come out and do a roast of Brant Malone. That's what I want.
So I'll start lining it up right away.
There you go. Okay, so I got this book, right? And I was like, oh, okay, this isn't. I like Richard Bushman. I want, okay, you've got my, now you have my attention. And then I started looking through some of the essays that were in there. This reads like a who's who of Mormon scholars. So let me just give you a few of them. Philip Barlow, Terrell Givens, Laurie Mathley Kipp, Kate Holbrook, Adam Miller, Jared Hickman, Jana Rees, Matt Groh, Matt Bowman, and that's just halfway through the book. Like, yeah. I was like, whoa, you guys brought out all the big guns. And for someone like Richard Bushman, who was as foundationally important, I'm really glad that all these people came out and wanted to write essays in honor of him on some really, really great subjects. So here's some of the sections that people wrote essays in. Historians are never innocents, looking at a historian's perspective and how it's difficult sometimes for you as a historian to be purely objective. Anxiety and obligation in scholarship, re-envisioning Mormonism, can historians quest after religious truth? Scholarship in its purest and best form, it is much better to err on the side of generosity, and two great benedictions, one closing essay and one essay by Richard himself. These were so touching and so great, and it's Brian, I know that you've got a little bit of the historian and the academic side in you. It seems like there really is a strong fraternity among.
Yeah. The one article they missed, though, that I'll say is the imposter's syndrome article, right? The idea that every historian out there that is working in the field feels like an imposter to the field and feels that what they're doing is just, you know, just making stuff up.
Yeah. Which, you know.
Yeah, we kind of are. Anyway. Yeah,
listen, I'm just doing the best I can. I don't know if this is going to be worthwhile or not. Let's talk about a few essays. Melissa Inouye is a great writer. She actually wrote one of my favorite essays in a book called A Book of Mormons, where she talks about the art and the culture of men that seem to have this instinct, Mormon men just seem to have this instinct when it comes to setting up and taking down metal folding chairs. It's one of my favorite articles or favorite essays.
So just real quick on that note, and I was thinking about Melissa's article when I did this. I was at Benchmark Books for an event a couple of weeks ago, and we had to bring out all the folding chairs for it. Mm-hmm. And I was jokingly saying that is an opportunity for me to exercise my priesthood. So,
gosh. Hey-o! Boy, those dad jokes, they're natural for you, huh?
they come with experience.
Ah, yes. So she writes this essay, and she's talking about her original journey of feelings teaching Chinese history, going from just being enamored by it to being conflicted by it and really disgusted by some of it, and then just getting at a point where she appreciates the complexity. And she said, this shift in my thinking has corresponded with a parallel shift in my own understanding of Mormonism. Actually, the history of the Chinese Communist Party is not so far off from the recent history of the LDS Church in terms of problems that arise when charismatic ideals are harnessed to human organization. This coupling facilitates great locomotive potential, but is also a liability. Charisma can disrupt organization. Organization can stifle charisma. As historians, our job is to learn to inhabit multiple worlds and to translate between them so that we and others can understand the meaning and worth of the lives of our fellow beings. As people accustomed to traversing spaces in between, Mormon academics can make an important contribution as they train others to think critically, expansively, and constructively to build bridges among people in a world that difference has made dangerous, wondrous, and divine. And I think, if I think about on Richard Bushman and what Richard Bushman has meant to me, I would say Bushman's Rough Stone Rolling was the first major dive. Well, I wouldn't say it was the first major. It was one of the key parts of my life where I really started getting into Mormon studies and Mormon history. And I'm sure so many other people are that way. But what I like about what Melissa's saying, and I think that her, really all the Mormon scholars that I know and like, do a great job of taking these complex Mormon subjects and trying to work with the lay Mormon membership to get them to think a little bit critically and expansively and constructively on these things, not to be able to sit there and say, no, no, no. See, I'm going to show you why this is all, why everything is right and that the church is right on everything and take the traditional apologetic route.
Yeah. But
take the route of let's just think about this.
Yeah. I mean, for many, many decades, the history was didactic in nature. And that's not just Mormon history, by the way. That's if you get to early Christian history, you get to early Jewish history. The documents that were being put out were primarily didactic, and you can't really expect anything else from a religious organization that has a vested interest in advancing itself. So, yeah, we did reach a point, and it's a point that was reached primarily because of the explosion of academic scholarship and of dissertation work and of the social sciences and Mormons being involved in that. I mean, that's one of the things that you know, say what you want about the Mormon Church. One thing that it has historically had is a pro-education emphasis. And I mean, yeah, I understand for women there's you know, get your education so you can become a better mom, and you know, that's a bunch of garbage, but the by and large we're talking about an educated group of people and who value education and value intellectual responses to faith. So I think she's absolutely right.
And I think that that's an important part of the Mormon scholarship experience is trying to take some of those roads and go a little bit more with that. So one thing you were talking about Mormon women. What was that statue that was? It was in Utah, and it's going to go to Washington, D.C. Was it Martha Hughes Cannon?
Yeah, Martha Hughes Cannon, right. And I guess, is I swapping that out for the Brigham Young statue, or is that just...
The story that I heard was it was going down to like the U.S. Senate building or one of the major Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Right, buildings. Because she was the first female senator.
Yeah. Well, I'm also thinking of like that during that time in Mormon history where Mormon women were legitimately going out and getting educations. I think she went to the University of Michigan or something like that for her medical degree. And so we have this interesting history there. So
we have historical documents of Brigham Young encouraging women to go out and get education in nursing fields and medical fields and bringing that knowledge back to Utah to try to increase nursing standards in Utah for sure.
So let's talk about another essay. Brian, my friend and yours, well, okay, he's not my friend. I hope I could call him my friend. Matt Groh. You know Matt.
I know Matt. I co-published an article with Matt.
You did. That's my
I worked with him for like he was my boss for 2 years. But so besides that,
I was going to say aside from being co-host with me on the Mormon News Report as the highlight of your life, you also published an article with him. So he wrote this great essay on what it's like. He was talking a little bit about the different paths that one could take as Mormon historian. So path number one, he called the Arrington path, where you're going to be a historian that's going into the LDS Church to try and get the LDS Church to focus a little more on legitimate history, or the Bushman path, where you could be a faithful LDS historian, but is focused on writing Mormonism for outsiders and focusing on that. And so he was talking a little bit about that dichotomy and how he chose, it took him a while, but he finally chose the path of working for the LDS Church. So he called it the Arrington path. And so he's quoting Arrington here. So Arrington wrote, "We are trained to publish for our professional colleagues, being honest, straightforward, fearless, analytical, raising questions." But he, Arrington, also recognized that church authorities and church audiences want and have a right to expect faith-promoting history. So here's what Matt wrote. "For both audiences, audiences of scholars and audiences of general church members, we must write history that is candid, professional, and true to the sources. I appreciate both Arrington's caution and his search for the divine in history. Quote, we will also not use history as a storehouse from which deceptively simple moral lessons may be drawn at random. Behind the personal decisions and the vast impersonal forces of history, we will also see divine purposes at work." And I think, Brian, when I look at Richard Bushman, that is what Richard Bushman has tried to do. He has tried to write for both audiences. And people got really mad at him for Rough Stone Rolling. He wrote a great, it's called On the Road with Joseph or something like that. It's his diary of what happened after Rough Stone Rolling was published. And some of the things he writes in there are just some of the hate mail that he got from members because he didn't write Joseph Smith in a hagiographic light. And then the hate mail from the academic community saying, oh, you were too nice on Joseph Smith. And I think that that's the reason why Rough Stone Rolling is so important. And all the work that Bushman has done, he has tried to be a great, great academic scholar. But I think as he's gone on and he's been, how would I phrase it, more secure in his academic footing, especially after the success of Rough Stone Rolling, he has been working with LDS membership to get them to go down some of these other roads. And I love that quote from Arrington, that we can't use history as a storehouse from which deceptively simple moral lessons may be drawn at random. And that's sometimes a problem that we have in the LDS Church. We like to do that with things.
So would you recommend this book?
I would say this. If you are someone who is interested in Mormon studies, if you are someone who likes Richard Bushman, you owe it to yourself to read this book for a few reasons. One, the essays are great. And two, you're going to find a lot of scholars that you may or may not have heard from who wrote some great essays, and they might be springboards for other things. So definitely, if you're that type of person, if you like Rough Stone Rolling, you're going to love this book.
And if I can offer a pairing for this book, I think that there was a book that was published not all that long ago from, I think it was from Deseret Book, maybe Religious Studies Center, Conversations with Mormon Historians, that had a lot of interviews in it with various historians that have had a strong legacy within the writing of LDS history. And these historians were all from a devotional standpoint, but there's definitely some nuance in these conversations that were had. So I would recommend that along with this. It's, you know, this one focuses, it's not focused on Richard Bushman. It's topics that would be inspired around Richard Bushman and what he kind of emulates and stands for.
And if I could add a triple combination to that.
Yeah.
Terrell Givens podcast interview that he did with Marlon Jensen is also really, Marlon Jensen was the former church historian, really, really good. And Marlon goes into a discussion of what it's like being a historian and being in his position that he was. So those three, this book, the Essays in Honor of Richard Bushman, that book, what was it? Conversations with Church Historians?
Conversations with Mormon Historians, not Church Historians.
Okay, Mormon Historians and the Terrell Givens podcast interview with Marlon Jensen. Those three.
Maybe Out of Obscurity by Patrick Mason.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
As a fourth.
Yeah.
Right. I think that had a Melissa Inouye article in it, dude, if I remember right.
Probably. She's great. So, she I recommend if you liked those kinds of things, definitely pick this book up. You will thoroughly enjoy yourself.
Yeah. It's one thing to study Mormon history. It's another thing to study about Mormon historians. And I think it's really neat to get both perspectives. So the book that you had mentioned also from Richard Bushman about his memoir that he wrote while he was writing The Rough Stone Rolling, his On the Road with Joseph. Just to give a quick plug for that, that was published by Greg Coford Books. And Greg Coford Books is pleased to offer a 15% discount to Mormon News Report listeners at their website at gregcoford.com. Just enter News Report, all one word, all capital letters, into the discount code box at checkout to receive your 15% off. Orders over $50 qualify for free domestic shipping. And the next scheduled release is Textual Studies of the Doctrine and Covenants, The Plural Marriage Revelation by William V. Smith. This book looks at the history of the 1843 plural marriage revelation verse by verse and contextualizes those verses, looking at strains from all the way back to 1831 as the things that are reflected in what is now known as Section 132 of the Doctrine and Covenants, and discusses its deep impact on Mormonism. It is now available for pre-order. So visit gregcoford.com, that's GREGKOFFORD.com, and enter News Report, all capital letters, all one word, at checkout to get your 15% discount as a Mormon News Report insider.
And go figure, that just tells you how much of a dolt I am. I didn't know that On the Road with Joseph Smith was published by Coford. So yeah, there's my seal of approval for that one as well. Folks, that is our show for the week. This show is brought to you by, say it with me now, The Cultural Hall Podcast. Be sure to check out the rest of the shows available at theculturalhall.com. Richie Stedman does interviews. He does more news commentary. And, you know, it's a nice companion episode to this one, since everyone's a companion nowadays.
And hey, we want to thank you for supporting the show and all of those who support us over on Patreon. If you want to get our deep cuts each week, check us out on Patreon at patreon.com/Mormon News Report, where for as little as $1 per month, you'll get access to our exclusive deep cuts, where we go a little bit deeper into the rabbit hole than we do during the main show. And, you know, maybe say a few naughty words. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, it's, listen, who knows what happens when the lights go down, the slow jams turn on, and, you know, I loosen my tie. As always, if you'd like to reach out to us directly, you can email us, mail@MormonNewsReport.com. If you want to leave us a voicemail, I love getting voicemails, 801-987-0192. If it's a hot take, like that kind of take, we'll play it on the air next week. We'll be back again next week with more news, commentary, and interviews with just a sprinkling of snark. Until then, we'll talk to you again after a while.